converse with the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The spotlight.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Some 12,000 migrants, mostly from Haiti, have been staying at a camp under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas. Department of Homeland Security saying that 6,500 migrants were taken to custody in advance of processing and removal from the U.S., and on Sunday, flights started to carry Haitian asylum seekers back home. The United Nations has voiced concerns at the U.S. deportation of mostly Haitian refugees. American rights groups have also demanded a halt to the deportations. Expulsions are taking place under a health order, citing the coronavirus pandemic. Now, to begin with this, let's go to Washington, D.C. Our correspondent, Colin Campbell's there. Colin, tell us more about this migration thing and the problems.
Yes, the crisis at the border is very troubling because of the policies that the U.S. has enacted on Haitian immigrants who have walked through Brazil, through South America, to get to the border. Can you imagine walking through Brazil and then walking to the border, just some of the atrocities that you face along the way? Well, thousands of Haitian immigrants have gone through this journey in hopes of a better life in America. And this is the welcome that they received. Border Patrol agents on horseback using whips to control them. Children starving, people starving, children crying, getting out of the way of these Border Patrol agents. The imagery is very shocking as we see these people who are already in a very destitute state being welcomed by America, so to speak, in a way that would make them seem like enemies of the country, make them seem like they are invaders to the country. And right now, the Biden administration is being harangued by many who are saying, listen, you need to retool U.S. immigration policy right now because the way you're treating these Haitians is ineffable. And right now, the Biden administration has been deporting thousands of immigrants back to Haiti. When they return, they're worse or no better off than they were when reaching the United States.
This is The Spotlight. You're watching The Spotlight with me, your host, Behrouz Mejdi. And as you see, we're discussing the migrant problem in the United States. Let me see who's joining me in this episode of The Spotlight. Okay, we have a professor with the City University of New York, Danny Shaw, who's joining us from New York. And later I'll be joined by author and political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation, Keaton Mansfield, also in New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Danny, as you know, U.S. authorities are taking advantage of this pandemic-related health rule called Title 42 health rule, and that was made under former President Donald Trump to expel many of the migrants without offering them, you know, the chance to seek asylum. Is this what Joe Biden had promised to do while he was running in the race for the White House?
Well, I think even beyond the bipartisan issues, whether Biden increases the number of Haitian immigrants and migrants in general who are allowed to come here or doesn't, we have to get in front of this narrative and underneath this narrative that people are just coming here because the United States is so great. What exists here is the relationship between a neo-colonizer and a neo-colony. Many of these Haitians were forced out of Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. They were living in Chile. They were living in Brazil. That situation was no longer tenable. So they continued to travel north, trying to make it to the U.S. and to be met here with insults, racism, humiliation, and even whips from the Border Patrol. The symbolism is huge in terms of how the U.S. ruling class and the U.S. population sees Haiti and Haiti's people. So I think this is an important educational moment so people understand the true relationship that exists between the most powerful imperialist country in the history of humanity and Haiti, which continues to be a neo-colony in the Caribbean.
Danny, maybe you've seen those pictures of U.S. border guards using, you know, horse reins to control immigrants. Some observers say that those pictures remind them of the violence seen during the slavery times in the U.S. How do you feel when you see such scenes? Is this how the land of opportunity deals with asylum seekers?
Yeah, the land of opportunity in big quotation marks. That's part of this mythology that capitalism and white supremacy tries to spread around the world. Those images of the whips and the patronizing tone of the racist white supremacist tone of those Border Patrol guards also harkens back to the 1915 and 1934 U.S. military occupation of Haiti when thousands of Marines stepped on Haitian dignity and Haitian sovereignty and tracked down the CACOs, the Haitian resistance fighters. The same thing has happened today in the neocolon, whether it was under the auspices of the now assassinated Jovenel Moise, or under Ariel Henry, the prime minister today, the PHTK, the party in power, continues to repress the Haitian popular movement. So Haitians are asking across the country and across the diaspora, when will we be afforded a chance to survive in our own homeland?
Okay. Now, author and public analyst for the Center for Public Innovation, Keaton Mansfield, is also joining us from New York. Good to have with us, Keaton. So the question I have for you is, there are some people who are blaming the policies of President Biden's for this influx of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. What factors play a role here?
Well, with the advanced people, you have to look back what happened. It's very
telling. Sorry, I got a... jump in. Keaton, we don't hear you, right? So let me just go back to Danny and give our technicians a little bit of time to see if they can fix this problem. Daniel, let our viewers hear your opinion on how President Trump's policies could be responsible for this influx of migrants.
And I would go way before President Trump or President Bush or Tweedledee or Tweedledum, two sides of the same coin. This is decades and centuries of unfettered colonialism and neocolonialism practiced on what many have called the U.S.'s backyard, the Caribbean, Central America, the entire hemisphere. The Haitian people want a new way forward. The Haitian leadership has communicated from Port-au-Prince and Cap-Haïtien their enthusiasm in seeing the message of Evo Morales going to Cuba and then to Venezuela, and CELAC, and Nicolas Maduro regrouping in Mexico City, the pivot of Lopez Obrador and the Mexican leadership denouncing the blockade of Cuba. And this is what the Haitian people want. The Haitian people want integration with their peers, south to south development.
not development based on the underdevelopment of Haiti. That's how they frame it, the development of underdevelopment. Haiti has incredible potential. It always has. It's been always punished because of its great resources under the subsoil. And, of course, its number one resource, the Haitian people. So the Haitian people are looking for a way forward based on the unity of oppressed people and the integration that Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, and now Bolivia and Peru have spearheaded.
Mm-hmm. Danny, there also writes groups criticizing the Biden administration. They say that the returns are inhumane, and that's because of the dire security and economic situation in countries like Haiti. Let's have your take on that.
Of course, they're 100% correct. And to hear Alejandro Mayorkas talk about how humane their treatment of Haitians was is ridiculous. It's an entire system predicated on treating other human beings as subhuman. But I think we have to go even deeper than these liberal critiques. And as I was saying, even if the U.S. were to, Biden were to increase the number, the cap to 200,000 new migrants allowed in, really, there's 10.5 million Haitians, and if you were to open up the border tomorrow because of these institutional, structural, historical, geopolitical issues, what Haitians would stay home in their homeland? And that same question goes for Dominicans and Mexicans and Salvadorians. When you're talking about so many years of inequality, of exploitation, of the devaluation of a people's currency, of occupation, of sanctions, of invasion, what choice do a people have but to flee in pursuit of the stolen resources, the stolen gold, the stolen coffee, the stolen emeralds? So I think this shift in Latin America that's going to play out as we speak at the General Assembly about 100 blocks from me right now, it's going to be very important to see what happens in the next few days. I mean, Latin America and the Caribbean are again on the rise.
Okay, we have Keaton Mansfield back on the phone for us. Keaton, go ahead with your comments. Sorry for that interruption.
Yes, well, that's very true. As I was at the United Nations building earlier today, only an hour ago, you see many different groups coming together in support of fighting back against U.S. imperialism, fighting for the sovereignty of their homeland, for the rights of their own people, against those in power in the U.S. And so Biden is not living up to what he promised to be on the campaign trail, which seems to be a popular tradition for American politicians to make promises that not only do they not follow through with, but in Biden's case, done the exact opposite, ramping up deportation, ramping up police funding, ramping up foreign intervention. This is, it's more than anything, it's scary to see that this is the state of the U.S. political climate and the politicians that are put in place to try to represent or pretend to represent the American people is just, it's a shame, it's a sham.
Keaton, rights groups argue that Title 42 is not based on science and is actually a violation of U.S.'s own immigration laws, and they're asking the president to reverse that policy. Now, would President Biden take heed of that and reverse the policy?
I find it unlikely. The U.S. constantly violates its own procedures, protocols. It violates UN procedures and international protocols. So the idea that Biden would, unless he's faced with perhaps severe retribution or severe criticism from his own internal party bureaucracy, from Democrats who are in power already, who have sold out to the system, sold out to imperialist practices, it would be very unlikely that Biden would do the 180, so to speak, and suddenly become the president that he pretended he was on the campaign trail.
Okay. Now, Danny, we had White House spokesman just recently announcing that the U.S. government has a range of program options and financial support in place that would assist Haitian nationals and authorities without specifying any further. What could those plans be?
Well, at the most, there'll be drops in the ocean, drops in the bucket. These are liberal band-aids that won't change anything fundamentally in Haiti. It's the core group. It's the Organization of American States and the UN acting under the auspices of the U.S. Embassy that have the final say in all things Haitian. This is an issue about Haitian self-determination. colonialism and the neocolonialism has always been a one-armed bandit extracting from Haiti. So for Jen Psaki or any representative of the Biden government or any U.S. government to try to project this benevolence towards Haiti is extremely hypocritical. The true benevolence would come in the form of reparations to the tune of billions and billions of dollars restored to the Haitian people for the historical wrongs that have been visited upon them by successive U.S. administrations, both Democrat and Republican.
Now, Keaton, we also have the UN Human Rights Office expressing disappointment that there have apparently not been any individual assessments of the cases of the migrants by the United States. Why shouldn't that happen?
Well, the U.S. has been guilty of human rights violations since the American War for Independence in 1776, be it persecution and military removal and extinction of Native American tribes here in the U.S., or during World War II, the imprisonment of Japanese Americans, or, of course, Jim Crow era and slavery. The U.S. has a long-standing history, the United States government has a long-standing history of human rights abuses, and then the U.S. will take this, however, and then make international claims that, no, China is the enemy, China is abusing human rights, Iran is abusing human rights, Cuba, Venezuela, Haiti, the list goes on and on. At this point, it seems that human rights, for the concept of human rights, has simply become a political bargaining tool for those in power, for the most powerful in the UN, Britain and the United States. So to toy with this idea that the U.S. will rightfully and thoroughly address human rights allegations, to me seems like nonsense. It would be very out of character for the U.S. state apparatus.
Danny, let's look at it from a different angle. Isn't it thanks to Washington's own policies and meddling in some countries' affairs that forces some people to leave their countries and look for better lives elsewhere, like in the U.S.? I mean, isn't it the case of chickens coming home to roost?
That's exactly correct, and not just some people, but millions and millions, if not billions. How many Libyans, how many Syrians, how many Afghans have died making the perilous trek across the Mediterranean, across Asia and in Europe, trying to find a better way. So people are going to follow capital. People historically are going to follow the very resources usurped from them. It really comes at no surprise. And this is going to continue to happen. The right-wing media blitz right now, they continue to call this Biden's border crisis, as though Biden somehow created all of this. This goes way deeper than any individual politician. This goes hemisphere and centuries deep. So it begs a much more critical perspective on U.S. foreign policy. And until there's a fundamental change in the relationship between U.S. hegemony and U.S. unipolarity in the world's people, nothing will change. And how hypocritical Biden was at the U.N. just a few hours ago talking about there's no new Cold War, will work with anybody. But look at the unfettered aggression against China, against Russia, against Vietnam, against Pyongyang, against any country who dares to defy U.S. unipolarity.
Mm-hmm. Keaton, let's have your opinion on the same question.
Well, I was always introduced to this topic through the analogy that when someone pulls a gun, when someone has a firearm, the safest place to be is behind the person holding the gun, and I think that translates pretty well into immigration into the United States. When U.S. and NATO toppled Gaddafi's Libya, thousands and thousands of Libyans flee to the United States, flee to France, flee to the West, because, quite frankly, the U.S. is the only country that the U.S. cannot orchestrate a regime change in. And so it's trying to, people are trying to go to the safest place, which ultimately ends up being going to the oppressor historically and currently. And so the U.S.'s attempt to, as Danny said, that constantly pushing this aggression against China, who's attempting to build infrastructure and build hospitals and schools and put capital, put money to good use. The U.S. doesn't want that. And so any sort of pro-China, or more specifically, any sort of anti-American government is going to be an enemy of the U.S. State Department, of the intelligence agencies, and in turn, has got to go. It's got to be destroyed. It doesn't matter the cost of human lives. Iraq, you know, Saddam had to go, no matter the cost. And so it's a historical thing. It's not even a phenomenon at this point. It is just a consistent foreign policy of the U.S. to take out anybody they don't like, no matter what the cost is.
Daniel, I got one last question for you, and I want Keaton also to comment on that. And that's if you can think of any solution to this migrant problem in the United States.
Well, we can definitely think of a solution. That solution is called socialism. That solution is called reparations. That solution is called fight back, the unity of all oppressed people. Until there's a people's government here from D.C. to Miami to Los Angeles, nothing's going to change. This system, capitalism, is based on the pillaging of people's resources across the world. That's why they've gone after Syria so savagely. Look at these cruel sanctions imposed upon Tehran and upon Caracas and Havana. And now you have further aggression against Nicaragua. And I think it's time for the American people to connect the dots that who is the aggression meted out against. Any system that does not conform with U.S. hegemony, immediately they are under the boot and under the gun of U.S. militarism.
Okay, Keaton, what's the solution to the immigrant problem?
I absolutely think there is a solution, and I've worked as a political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation, and we have proposed the policy solution, which is the Sandino-Zapata Economic Corridor. The United States, China, and Russia should partner together. They should invest the money that currently goes into arms manufacturing and maintaining nuclear weapons. Take that money and invest it into a sort of Central and South American Belt and Road Initiative. Build infrastructure. Build factories. Build schools and build hospitals in cooperation with the government of Central America. And then after these things are built, turn them over, turn the management and the ownership of these roads, the schools, and public facilities completely over to the government of that country. Make it viable for people to stay in their homeland. Make it economically viable for people in Central and South America to remain in their homeland, remain where their families have been for generations, and live a very, very good and robust life without having to be concerned about where food's coming from. Is the U.S. going to kill our president tomorrow? That's the solution.
Okay. Okay, and that will come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We have professor at the City University of New York, Daniel Shaw, in New York, and author and political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation, Keaton Mansfield, also in New York. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najaf, and I'll see you next time.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? Oh, Kali, she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deen al-Arab, ghayrun deen Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. This program, Islamic Laws, we are going to deal with the laws related to taqlid or following mujtahid according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hawza lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy, like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Halli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Halli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about taqlid-related Islamic laws according to Ayatollah Sistani. Is it permissible to do taqlid of a mujtahid or following a religious authority in matters that are not conspicuous and clearly defined? Could you give more examples, some examples of such issues, please?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, we do know that taqlid has something to do with ambiguous and, let's say, with ambiguous issues and those issues which are not clearly defined.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Issues the legal disciplines or topics which are clearly defined. Let's say prayer is obligatory and there are 2 rakahs of Fajr prayer, there are 4 rakahs of midday prayer,
mm-hmm.
noon prayer,
yes.
and 4 rakahs of afternoon prayer, and so 3 rakahs of Maghrib prayer. Every individual and every religious authority knows that these are the prayers and these are the rakats, okay, these are the units.
You're talking about certain issues or unambiguous issues.
Yeah, unambiguous issues. These are called dharuri or not clearly defined, okay, because the word dharuri has been translated wrongly by some translators.
I see.
Dharuri actually means clearly defined and conspicuous, okay?
Or unambiguous, yes.
Yes, unambiguous. Now, when it comes to those issues which are not clearly defined, of course, those are controversial issues, and those are issues which are understood by the religious authorities differently,
mm-hmm.
because there are different reports, there are different narrations, and even the verses of the Quran are not very, say, straightforward, and they are not very, you see, lucid, very explicit. And therefore, controversies there, the scholars are not unanimous about those issues. Those are controversial issues, contentious issues, and it's necessary, it's obligatory to follow a mujtahid in those issues only, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the clearly defined issues, of course, it is a matter of consensus among all religious authorities that it's not necessary for a duty-bound person, a mukallaf, to follow a mujtahid. And of course, we know that taqlid is irrelevant to those. Taqlid applies only to these issues and not to the principles of faith, not to the roots of religion, because in those issues we have to follow. We have to follow our own insight, our own understanding. We have to believe in God, for example, in the unity of God, in oneness of God, in the day of resurrection, and also in the prophethood of the Holy Prophet. With our own insight, without relying on our parents, without relying on anyone, on any scholars, or without following anyone, because taqlid does not actually
apply to those areas. Those principles, in fact, do not lend themselves to such issues as taqlid.
Sure.
And everybody should, reach a point on their own. To make sure that, for example, as you said, the unity of God and the rest of it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. If you agree, let's take a break and we'll be back talking more about Islamic laws related to taqlid according to Ayatollah Sistani. Stay with us.
Good.
The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are talking about Islamic laws pertaining to taqlid or following a religious authority according to Ayatollah Sistani. Sheikh Javid, why is it that mujtahids differ in their opinions about inconspicuous issues or ambiguous issues? It's a question that comes to everybody's mind.
Mm-hmm.
When you, the previous question that I asked you was related to or made a hint at, let's say, inconspicuous or unambiguous or not clearly defined issues.
Sure.
But what about the inconspicuous or ambiguous issues? When it comes to those issues, those small details, you see a lot of differences among religious authorities.
You're right. To be honest, some people do believe that, okay, we have the same Quran, we have the same tradition, And why should the scholars understand the Quranic verses differently?
Mm-hmm.
And they are very explicit in their purport and their content. And this is just an objection raised by some people who are angry about some scholars, because especially when it comes to the Eid occasion, okay, Eid, for example, on the day of Eid, some scholars, some religious authorities announce the Eid day, and the other scholars, some other scholars, still advise their followers to continue fasting.
Mm-hmm.
So, these differences are very natural, and we need to come to terms with these differences, because the Quranic verses and the sayings of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, can be subject to different interpretations. And of course, the religious authorities do not try to exert their own opinion or give their own personal opinion about something being halal or haram, or about something being recommended or disapproved. Okay, they put all their efforts into finding out what is possibly and probably the injunctions of God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and of course, when a mujtahid comes to know that this could be that, because the ruling, it's all about inconspicuous issues, okay? And of course, it's the duty of scholars to delve into the Quran and the sources of Islamic laws, which is the Quran, and the Quran is the most important source, and then followed by the Sunnah, and then the consensus, and also the reason, aql. These are the four major sources from which the Quranic, the Islamic laws are derived. Okay, and of course, to make a long story short, I would say that in these matters, it's essential for every individual, for every duty-bound person, to follow the most qualified mujtahid, because the more qualified a mujtahid, the less he is likely to make a mistake.
I see.
Yeah. And that's the reason why the scholars emphasize on following the most learned and the most eligible the scholar.
Sheikh Javid, let me squeeze in a quick question.
Sure.
Is it permissible to follow two different religious authorities or mujtahids in a single subject of Islamic jurisprudence?
Well, it's not permissible. It's not permissible. Given the assuming that two scholars are equally qualified, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, first of all, it's very difficult. It is probably impossible to identify two equally qualified mujtahids, to understand that these two scholars are equally qualified.
Mm-hmm.
No one can claim that he is able to identify those two equally qualified. Okay, theoretically speaking, according to scholars, according to the religious authorities, if two equally qualified jurisprudents are there, one can follow those two scholars, those two religious authorities, in two different subjects of Islamic jurisprudence. For example, you can follow one mujtahid in the issues related to transactions, to business, mm-hmm. to trade, to commerce, and another mujtahid in matters related to acts of worship, like praying, fasting, giving, let's say,
homes. Permissible?
Yeah, of course, it is permissible. And even if there are two subjects, for example, you follow a mujtahid, provided that, you know, I'm saying again, that those two scholars must be equally qualified, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You cannot choose a scholar who is less qualified, but whose fatwa is easier and more simpler, and let's say, more accessible, okay? For these reasons, you cannot follow him. But, okay, if those two scholars are equally qualified, you can follow one mujtahid in matters related to khums, and another mujtahid in matters related to salat, okay?
Yes,
but you cannot follow two mujtahids in regard with the same single issue like salat. For example, when it comes to ruku, when it comes to salat itself, you cannot follow two different mujtahids, even if they are equally qualified.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
According to the results of parliamentary elections in Russia, United Russia ruling party received a constitutional majority in the State Duma. The Communist Party took the second place, with the Liberal Democratic Party the third one. Then goes Fair Russia and New People. Thus, these five parties overcome the 5% barrier to enter the State Duma. United Russia is promoting President Vladimir Putin's agenda, which is also enshrined in last year's social amendments to the Constitution.
I want to thank all our voters who voted for United Russia and our candidates. This is a great trust and no less great responsibility for us. I also want to thank those who voted for other political parties. We respect your position and the choice you made.
The State Duma is elected in Russia for a five-year term under a mixed system. 225 deputies, according to party lists, another 225 in single-mandate constituencies in one round. The results haven't been without controversy, however. There have been widespread accusations of fraud and misconduct. Throughout the 3 days of voting, many videos shared online appeared to show voters and officials stuffing ballot boxes with multiple voting slips. In Moscow, some opposition figures accused officials of delaying the release of online voting results to give them an opportunity to manipulate. In response, Kremlin hailed the parliamentary elections as open, competitive, and honest.
Voter turnout was notably high, especially on the last day of voting. This election will also be remembered by a large number of candidates.
The team of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny accused the authorities of foul play, declaring all the victories against his candidates they supported as part of a controversial smart voting scheme as falsification. Earlier before the elections, Russia's telecom watchdog demanded the Navalny app be removed from App Store and Google Play based on a ruling by the Russian Prosecutor General's office.
For the first time this year's federal elections in Russia took place over 3 days. This year, election organizers have also introduced electronic voting devices. So far, residents of only seven regions in Russia have been able to vote using these devices. According to the Constitution, the new State Duma should meet on the 30th day following the election day.
But the president has the right to convene the first meeting of the lower house of parliament even earlier than this date. The Russian president has already exercised this right after previous elections. Марина Картунова, Москва.
The issue centers around a contract signed 5 years ago worth up to 50 billion euro for France to build 12 submarines for Australia. Out of the blue, Paris found out a few days ago that the deal is off. France is furious, and so too is the EU. Talks on a new trade deal between the 27-nation bloc and Australia took place in June and were due to resume in October. We're told that's now in doubt.
We are analysing the impact of the AUKUS announcement and what this impact could be on this schedule.
AUKUS is a new security deal signed between the US, Britain and Australia. It means France's submarines are no longer required. The country's foreign minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, says it's a stab in the back from allies.
There will be consequences, of course, for the French relationship with the US, with Australia, with the UK, but that also implies there will be consequences for the relationship between the EU and these countries.
Senior EU ministers will discuss their response to the diplomatic crisis in the early hours of Tuesday morning, Brussels time.
There will be a meeting of EU 27 foreign ministers, chaired by HMVP Borrell in New York on the margins of the UN General Assembly.
Paris has already withdrawn its ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. The AUKUS nuclear submarines will use the latest undersea technologies in the South China Sea. Beijing says the move smacks of Cold War mentality. North Korea warns it could trigger a nuclear arms race. Political analysts are suggesting Australia and Britain need to be very circumspect when dealing with the US. They point to all the international agreements Trump pulled the plug on. Also, Biden indicated he would rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. That still hasn't happened. And look at the impact of US unilateral decisions with respect to Afghanistan. Many are asking, can Washington really be trusted? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A lengthy parliamentary session was held in Beirut to discuss the cabinet manifesto and give the Miqati cabinet a vote of confidence. Session began with an address by the Prime Minister, who briefed the members of parliament on the most significant issues which will be dealt with.
The socio-economic challenges should be among our top priorities. The government has no way but to put its focus on reforms to pave the way for uplifting the economy, developing the productive sectors, and attracting foreign investment. In addition to these files, we need to have an independent judicial body.
Prime Minister stressed that his cabinet will directly begin negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, and its main objective will include the general reforms and a restructuring of the banking sector. In light of Lebanon's current dire economic descent, majority of Lebanese lawmakers decided to give a confidence vote to a cabinet which considers itself in a state of relief efforts.
We want to give Lebanon a chance to recover and to stop the collapse that is happening, the free fall that is happening, actually. And this is why we're giving it a chance, actually, based on also a program that we discussed with the Prime Minister and that included a lot of the requirements and the requests we have put in it.
Miqati's 24-member cabinet is also expected to offer solutions to shortages of medicine and fuel and to launch a social welfare card as a compensation for the local currency's lost value.
The government is expected to address all of these problems together, but they have to prioritize the problems. The Lebanese now, the mere Lebanese, the lay Lebanese, and the majority of the Lebanese are not capable of meeting their basic needs in order to survive. So we pin the hopes on the government to be able to prioritize the needs of the people and to address the most important. When we talk about the most important, we talk about the financial crisis, we talk about correcting the level of the wages for the Lebanese, or even to give a compensation so they can meet their basic needs.
The Miqati cabinet has vowed to prepare for parliamentary elections and hold them on time in May of 2022.
The Miqati cabinet has stressed in its manifesto that now is the time for action and not words. The lawmakers, for their part, have considered that this government and all future cabinets must work on rebuilding the economy instead of relying on grants and loans. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Far away from their homes, the battle for survival continues for thousands of Rohingya refugees living across India. After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of the world. But in India, they are sometimes called illegal immigrants and threat to national security, which activists describe as a deliberate attempt to target a particular community. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities. But these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
There is no evidence whatsoever about Rohingyas being involved in anything even close to terrorist activity. This is the paranoia of the Indian deep state, which increasingly wants to do all this fear-mongering to increase its budget.
Based on analysis of the Government Crime Records Agency for 2020, Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Analysts say there is no case of terror, rape, or keeping arms against any Rohingya refugee, which belies the government claim of calling them a security threat.
We just want to stay alive. We are no threat to anyone since we are humans and have family too. We are really in a miserable state as a detention and expulsion campaign is going on.
Based on official estimates, some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India. Many refugees I spoke with had almost similar views. They say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against the community are haunting them. As refugee crises continue to be the biggest challenge facing the world, rights activists say Rohingya community in particular has largely been ignored despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy regardless of the geostrategic interest and stand by its ethos considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Protesters set up a cage outside Denmark's embassy in Iran, a cage with a cake inside to celebrate the fifth birthday of Dariush. This is the second year in a row that Dariush's mother, Mahsa, celebrates her son's birthday without him, as Dariush has been taken away from his family by the Copenhagen municipality for parental incompetence reasons, something which the distraught mom dismisses as unfair. She says she misses her son.
پسرمان اوتیسم داشته باشه.
My son suffers from autism, but the Danish authorities blame me for all of my son's disorders like inability to sleep or eat. I was even referred to a pediatrician who approved that my son is an autistic. But the authorities in Denmark refused to accept the reality and accused me of misbehavior toward my child. I urge the Iranian government and the foreign ministry to take measures so I can see my son again.
Mahsa has lived in Denmark for 6 years, but does not have the Danish permanent residency. She says she and her husband have both agreed to return to Iran, but Copenhagen refuses to grant them their son's custody. Rights activists here demand that the Danish government help Mahsa reunite with her son.
In every country, the law says that if a family is unfit to keep in the custody of their children, the government must remove the children from that family. But regarding Mahsa's case, the Danish government needs to hand the affected child to the relative Iranian entities to take care of the issue. Because Mahsa does not have a permanent Danish residency, and the case should be delegated to her country of origin.
While it was not possible for journalists and Mahsa to reach the Danish embassy to investigate the matter, Mahsa says she continues to publicize her cause and try any available legal channel to take her son back.
Apparently, it takes a lengthy and complicated legal procedure for Mahsa to get to her son. But what's clear is that 5-year-old Dariush is now living far from his mom, and nothing can replace the peaceful bosom of a mother for a child. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thirteen days after breaking out from Gilboa Jail, Israel's maximum security prison, Ayham Kamamji and Munadal Infi'at were rearrested by Israeli forces during a military incursion into northern city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Kamamji and Infi'at, both members of the Islamic Jihad movement, were the last of six Palestinian prisoners who escaped Gilboa prison on September 6. Like their fellow inmates, they were immediately taken to an unknown place for interrogation, and the Israeli authorities have extended their detention to continue the interrogation process. Palestinian Authorities Commission of Detainees Affairs held Israel responsible for their lives and said it's illegal to retry prisoners who are already serving sentences and life sentences.
Israelis are trying to cover up the scandal of the prison break. The prisoners who succeeded to flee were serving life sentences. Now, Israel's decision to extend their detention under interrogation serves only to soothe the public outrage on Israeli streets. We warn Israeli authorities against harming the prisoners, especially if they continue placing them in solitary confinement for lengthy periods after their interrogation.
The inmates were arrested after a large number of Israeli troops raided different parts of Jenin. Clashes broke out between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers in a number of locations, with stones and explosives thrown towards Israeli forces. A number of Palestinians were moderately wounded during the clashes, according to medics. Moreover, two Palestinians were arrested during the operation. The Israeli military claims they had helped Kamamji and Infi'at hide in Jenin.
Israel boasted of a security image, but it was tarnished by the Palestinian inmates' prison break. Now, even the rearrest of the last two inmates in Jenin cannot boost the image. The prison break was a great blow for Israel.
Last weekend, Zakaria Zubaydi, Mahmoud Arda, Mohammed Qadiri, and Mohammed Arda were captured by Israeli forces in and near Nazareth, northern the occupied lands. Their lawyers said the men have been subjected to physical and mental abuse and torture by Israeli interrogators, and each of them is placed in 2-by-1 square meter room lacking basic necessities for life.
Palestinians say Israel's security failure can never be rectified by the rearrest of the six prisoners or through the Israeli military operations across the occupied territories. They add the fact at the end of the day proves that the jailbreak has embarrassed Israel's security establishment.
The rearrest of the last two remaining Palestinian inmates who had escaped from an Israeli jail has sparked public outrage among the Palestinians. Palestinians have come together in the Gaza Strip to voice their anger at Israel's growing pressure on the Palestinian inmates.
We in the Gaza Strip stress that fight against the Israeli occupation will go on and the rearrest of the inmates won't deter us from expressing our solidarity with them. The prison break of the Palestinian inmates has inflicted a heavy blow on Israel's image. The resistance front has vowed to set them free in the coming exchange deal. We will never forget this achievement.
Reports say the two men were caught alive in Jenin, their hometown in the West Bank, after they were surrounded by Israeli army.
We have come here to